Hey, what is up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Today's episode is a pod for pod matchup with the Pitchworks podcast, hosted by my guest, Scott McTaggart. Both of our episodes are going live today, so encourage you to check out his show. That was episode 50 that I helped him celebrate. We talked podcasting, sales, how to ask good questions, just a really fun conversation. Scott has an excellent personality. And that shines through in the conversation that you're about to hear, where we talk in depth about sales and marketing. Scott has held a number of different sales positions, and we just talk through on a really 101 level the mistakes that people make, lessons that he's learned through his career, and where he sees things going in the future. It gets a little bit darker towards the end of the episode, but a really interesting perspective that I'm excited to be sharing with you. If you enjoy this podcast and you're going to love our event, January 27th in Pittsburgh, the Going Deep Summit is going to host a fantastic lineup of previous guests like Zach Slayback, Leah Lizarondo, Ed Lattimore, and many other interesting folks. Head on over to goingdeepwithaaron.com/event to check that out. We've also got a ton of great episodes coming down the pipe, but let's not talk about the future. Let's stay in the present and enjoy my conversation with Scott McTaggart.
You're listening to Going Deep with Aaron Watson.
So we're here, we're live. In the basement of Epicast Studios, talking to Scott McTaggart. Scott, we just recorded your 50th episode.
Yeah, I'm super psyched.
It's airing at the same date as this one, which is the 20th of September.
Yeah.
And if people just listen to this and they say, God damn, I cannot get enough of Scott and Aaron's voice, where should they go?
Well, I would direct them to pitchworks.com. where all the back catalog and everything is. You don't have to subscribe at that point. You don't have to commit. You can just check us out and just see pitchworks.com/podcast. Our episode will be there. Now, obviously, I'd prefer for you to go to the, you know, the iTunes or the Google Play or the Stitcher or the Libsyn, whatever you use, and say, hey, let's subscribe to that Pitchworks thing too. Because you know what? I mean, if they have Aaron on there, they can't be all bad.
You have good taste in guests.
I do. I've got great, excellent taste in guests.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, I'm excited to be talking with you, and I'm excited to add another conversation to the audience's catalog of folks who think about sales and think about pitching and think about marketing and the development of that skill set, because that is a skill set that, you know, at the end of the day, it's very rep-based. It's very experience-based. There isn't really a substitute for it. But there really also isn't necessarily a linear stair-step growth trajectory for that. Sometimes there is. You can become the sales guy and then the sales manager, blah, 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 blah.
No,
blah.
You're right.
But in terms of where you go with that is not always clearly defined. So before we get directly into that, I just want to ask you what your first job in sales was.
Okay, so a lot of people wouldn't count this, but it was the first time I realized that I actually enjoyed it. So when I was in high school, I used to play ice hockey. Ice hockey is an expensive sport, especially back then, because there was maybe 3-4 rinks around where you could take your high school hockey team and play, right? So we had to do the fundraisers, community day type things, you know, like, can you shoot this puck through this small hole in this board kind of things, right? And I loved it. I was pulling people out of the crowd. You know, like, this is where you find out that not only are you good at it, but you really enjoy original pitches. And I'm 15, 14-ish, and I'm just grabbing these people up. And then I start realizing this will also let me talk to girls. So I'm doing that too. Ladies, you want to find out whether or not you can shoot a hockey puck? That is a very pointed ask. And I'm like, I'm pulling levers that I wouldn't realize what they meant until, you know, 10 years later, but I loved it. You know, figuring out what works, figuring out to what extent I can push the envelope and grinning the whole way. So that was kind of the first go. And then, you know, I did some other things, but honestly, I would say where I really kind of grew up in terms of understanding what was really wanted out of this function, what's desirable, is I actually worked for the Rorick's. I sold cars. I was involved in a bit of a startup enterprise, and my heart wasn't really in my undergraduate studies, so I stopped and I started selling cars. And I'm, like I said, I've got this little startup enterprise that, you know, I'm kind of involved in it. I didn't found it, but I'm helping the founder, and I know that I like that a lot more than I like college. Like, marketing wasn't really what I thought it was going to be. They had us on track to become consultants, and I really wanted something smaller, something more boutique, right? And this was like prepping us to go work for a bank, and I hated every inch of it.
Yeah.
Now, next thing you know, you're on a car lot, and literally, if you don't sell, you don't eat. So I'm 19 years old, and I'm hustling cars and loving life. Like, these are people, and, you know, your word is your bond. You come through or you don't. They tell their friends or they don't, right? You know, it has to work. So, yeah, I mean, I have this theory that whatever you sell first is who you are, like, for the rest of your career.
Okay.
There's a part of me that's a car salesman forever and ever. And it's, I mean, it's a substantial enough part that, you know, I still think that.
How long ago was the last time you sold a car?
Oh God, it's been 100 years now. So I was like 21 when I left that business, 22 maybe. So I'm 40 now. So yeah, I mean, we're coming up on 20 years later, but I'm still, like, there's a part of me that just thinks that way, where it's person to person, it's trust, it's handshakes, it's look people in the eye.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, look, I could have been raised in one of those bad, I mean, the trope and cliche of like the car salesman is well traveled, right? Everybody's heard these stories. Half of them are true. No, I mean, I was selling new Volkswagens, new Mazdas, and working with a crew of younger guys that just kind of didn't want to be anything but what, you know, people expected them to be. I want to show up. I want you to take me for a drive. I want you to tell me you can get it for me in red. But you still have to deal with, you know, a lot of different things. People's personal opinions about you, people's personal opinions about what a transaction looks like, how it works, you know, how does a finance operation work? Like, you know, you have to navigate all these different things, and you have to do it with somebody that you don't know. And, you know, I mean, I've sold some hilariously large things at this point, but it's not that much more complicated, in depth, whatever. It's the same job.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a good time. I enjoyed it quite a bit. You can't stay in one. Well, okay. I can't stay in one place for too long though. You know, you start to realize, like, you know, you're becoming part of the scenery.
Yeah.
So it became time to move on. And I went on to work in business to business, which is actually where I really belong. You know, it's my best fit. And I've been there ever since. I mean, you know, just working with people that are going to commit budgets and resources and have a more organized way raises the stakes, makes it a little bit more complex, makes the puzzle a little bit harder to solve. And I mean, really, if you know that about me, you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah. I've been really interested with, and quite frankly, just learned a lot in the last 2 years about the through lines between, you talked about studying marketing in college, practicing sales, and then the third corner of building a brand and having a reputation. And I'm blanking on the book. I was trying to remember the whole time you're giving that answer what the book was, but there was some guy who's like the best car salesman in the history of the state of Michigan.
Okay.
And they were asking him, like, how does he mentally approach the sales? And he says, when I'm talking to someone, I'm thinking about the second and third car that they buy from me. And that's like the perspective that he brings to it. And you can see how that type of mindset completely rips away the viability of the sleazier methods.
Yes.
Of hooking someone up with a lemon.
You heard me say it even in my answer when I said they won't tell their friends about it.
Right.
You have to have that on your radar.
And that's the same thing. And that's the part that I think it's just fundamentally hard to convey and hard to teach a new salesperson, because when you are in that situation where you have to sell to eat, it just, your priorities are different. Your incentives are different. It's hard to think in those terms.
Society has done a number on your headspace. Okay. This is not an episode of, you know, What Grinds My Gears with, you know, with Peter Griffin. I'm not going in that direction at all. But If you weren't raised to understand that transactions are key to every business, then you start to look at movies, TV, cocktail party conversation, whatnot, for your understanding of what the job is and what it is not, and what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. I'll give you an example. There are people who believe that you have to tell a lie in order to make a sale happen. There are people who believe that lots of lies have to happen in order for a sale to happen.
I know multiple people who believe that, like within my network. I know that that's what they think.
Now, as I like to say on my show, your mileage may vary, but here's how I avoid that problem. I think that when you interact with a sales rep, what you are doing is you are bringing in a third party, whether or not that salesperson has been hired to be a third party or not. Okay? So let's say that I work for Aaron Corp. I am a rep. I go and I sit down with Bonnie, and Bonnie is our client. And Bonnie says, I hear the new, you know, Model 1000 is the greatest thing ever. If I say yes, what does that mean about me?
You're just telling people what they want to hear?
Yep. And that I don't have my own independent identity, right? I am essentially superfluous to this transaction. I'm just an ugly fringe benefit. Hey, I showed up dressed nicely, right? Congratulations, I'm here. If instead I say, well, Bonnie, it is a very, very good product. However, I need to be very clear with you about the support costs as opposed to the one that you've got now, because it's not just about the initial transaction. You also have to think about how you're going to have to change the rest of what you do. And there are costs associated with that too. I'd love to have your business, but you and I need to be on the same page as far as what the expectations are going forward. That's my brand intervening, my brand that she's actually investing in. And that's the trick. The trick is get up on your hind legs and fight for yourself.
Yeah. And even in the instance of the superstar all-American salesperson,
that's the guy who does it the most.
The reason they have the unparalleled Rolodex, the reason that they can make the call that can change the trajectory of your business, is because they've laid that groundwork over and over and over and over again, so that that idea that your word is bond. Like that's actually something, it's like, it's either a parody in a lot of movies, or just not even really like the context, like the important characteristic that the character you're watching embodies. But that is, I mean, that's underrated. Would you say that's underrated?
I would say that people prioritize control over trust. And this is a problem. If you've ever done anything with like a public entity, they will run what they call an RFP, a request for proposals. And the RFP is designed to remove variation between submissions. Okay? It's intended to commoditize all the responses. So Bonnie now, she wants to buy the Model 1000. She goes back to her purchasing agent and says, we need to put out a bid for Model 1000. Write it to that specification. Now, we're the only company that makes the Model 1000 here at Aaron Corp. However, the people over at Buzzy Corp have the Model 151, which is their version of that. And it is spec for spec the same thing. Maybe there's a couple variations, but they're not material to the bid. They do that because they think that that's what they need to do, is they like to call it apples to apples and those kinds of things. What they've now done though is remove that expert input from the people who work with it every day, because now those people have no incentive to come in and tell you like, okay, let's be honest about this. You've essentially said that you don't think that they add any value to it. And you buy it. And now there's all these costs associated with it that you would have heard about had you engaged my brand, me as the rep in between the manufacturer corporation and the client. Now you put out a bid. You said that you want to buy it. I'm not going to argue with you. You sent it to 27 of my competitors, right? It's like you're pretty committed at this point.
Yeah.
You get it. Now all of a sudden you've got a major unbudgeted expense. We've been doing this way for decades, and it hasn't changed because the control is so hard to give up. They will not give up control. And that's okay. It's their prerogative. It's their money. They're allowed to do what they want. My statement to you is that your rep's job, if they're doing their job correctly, is to save you from yourself sometimes, or at least keep you from looking stupid, which also happens.
Yeah, I dig that. And you serve as advisor for certain startups. Yes. You are active in this kind of Pittsburgh startup ecosystem mm-hmm. that is flourishing recently. And I'm just going to like kind of play devil's advocate here for a second and let you bounce back at me. This notion that brand has reached its peak, the importance, the significance of brand has reached its peak because a mega platform like Amazon commoditizes a lot of the products that used to live off of brand. Mm-hmm. Duracell versus Amazon Basics, what's the difference?
Right.
Amazon is just going to automatically order the basics for you, and I don't really care that much about my batteries, so why would I select Duracell?
Yep.
Not that every startup here is making some sort of commodity like that, but there's this kind of broad, I would say, you get from like the tech sector that either if I build it, they will come, or we will create the perfect funnel so that you never have to touch a salesperson.
So now we're
getting
a lot of sins are getting mixed in the pot together, though.
Yeah, it's getting murky.
Well, and that's the real world. Like, you're bringing it up that way because it's how you find it.
Yeah.
But if you're going to analyze it and troubleshoot the problem, you have to take it one at a time. Okay, so let's deal with the first thing you raised. The reason that Amazon Basics is accepted as the same is because Duracell agreed to that. They did it to themselves, and they're still okay with it. There's a really good chance they're the ones who make Amazon Basics. Let's start there, right? I mean, if you're going to build batteries,
yeah,
you could pick a worse brand to do it for you, right? But go deeper. You've got a brand that certain people swear by. They go, Duracell batteries are the only ones I use, right? You've got musicians who are like, oh yeah, you know what? I throw out the old copper tops before every new show and I put new ones in, right? They swear by it. They're just used to it. They buy the same thing every time because why change something if you don't have a reason? So Duracell says, you know what? Let's have some profit loss, you know, because I mean, we don't have to have every penny, every little thing. Now let's get deeper into the Amazon effect in general, right? If you want a particular brand, can't help but notice you've got a MacBook there, right? Now, if you typed in laptop and Amazon just sent you an Acer running Windows 10, you would have been unsatisfied because it's not what you wanted. Now, I can make the argument that they essentially do the same thing. Keyboard, check. Now we're back to our RFP mode, right? Yeah. Does it have a keyboard? Yeah. Does it have a trackpad? Sure does.
Yep.
How big's the screen? Is it OLED? You bet it is. Brother, let me tell you something. It's so much cheaper than that Apple, right?
Yeah.
And you could make that decision and nobody challenge you on it. Oh, but Scott, let me tell you about the fact that it's a unibody construction milled from one consistent piece of aluminum. You've decided to prioritize that, but you didn't do it on your own. You did it with their help. They told you, hey, by the way, MacBook lasts longer because it's not 12 pieces of plastic. It's one piece of aluminum, right? They were smart and aggressive, and they still managed to seem cool instead of overly, they're not pushing it on you. They're making it welcome. That's a better way of saying it. They're welcoming you to the information and making it accessible, and you want to digest the information. That's why so many people, when you ask them who they want to be, the cliche tired answer is, I want to be Apple Computer. I mean, there's a lot right there. And yeah, you could want to be Duracell. There's nothing wrong with being Duracell. Frankly, if I was heir to the Duracell empire, I promise you I wouldn't be sitting in the basement of the Epicast Studios. I'd probably be saving the whales or something really meaningful, right? You know?
Yeah.
But you get to a point where it's like, okay, well, do we have to win every fight? And that's, I think, where Duracell's at is, do we have to win every fight? And next thing you know, the commoditization creeps in and anybody could sell Duracell. You and I could right now decide that we're going to form a battery company. And all we're going to do is sell batteries. And Duracell is never going to restrict us from being able to buy their battery because they know it's a commodity just as much as everybody else does. Yeah. How's that for way too deep of an answer on that question?
That's precisely what I love and why I wanted to ask you about this stuff, because it is the perspective of a practitioner that actually elicits real insight.
Can we call it Going Too Deep with Scott McTaggart? Just curious, just this week, just this one time.
Special edition.
Going Too Deep.
Yeah.
God, please stop talking.
No, but honestly, like, these are the, there's like two parts of the training that I think the entrepreneur needs. They need the basic tool belt of, I'm walking into a meeting with a prospect, with a potential client. How do I move them from no to yes in this conversation? How do I present the information so that it is clear, so that I can explain the value to them, so that I can be forthright and have those interpersonal skills?
Okay. So,
and simultaneously,
are we expletive friendly here?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me unfuck this for you. Ready?
Yeah.
All the entrepreneur needs is to believe that they are doing good.
That's a foundational piece.
No, that's it. It's literally the whole shebang. Everything else we do, the way we dress, the way we practice, the way we design the pitch deck, it's all designed to trick you, your mind, you tricking you into believing that you deserve to ask for the check. Because when you get to that level where you're confident enough to do it, people will do what you tell them to do. People respond to you the way you tell them to respond to you. As long as they actually believe that you believe it. Now, is this 100% of the time? No. Sometimes they don't have money. Sometimes they don't actually want the product, even though they said they do. Sometimes the timing is bad. Sometimes they have a boss that says no. Sometimes they don't relate to you, so they don't think you actually believe it. They don't see your faith in your proposal in your eyes. But literally, everything else we do is designed to get you to a point where you think it's time to ask, and you know it. I teach a five-step, typically. We jokingly refer to it as the five and a half steps to sell anything, right? I don't teach a mental model because mental models sell stuff. I teach a mental model because it gives you confidence that you know what to do next, so that when it comes time to ask for the check, you go, oh, I'm at the end of the mental model, and it's totally cool to ask for a check now. But people don't come to this normally. They don't come to it naturally. This is an unnatural thing, to go in front of people, ask for their acceptance, and then ask for their money. So you have to build a platform upon which they are comfortable putting their weight. And everything else is in service of you, not them.
Tell me a story. You don't have to necessarily like name the name, but you've worked with these different companies. Tell me a story that would give hope to someone who's never sold the thing.
So let me start off with, you've heard of beginner's luck?
Yeah.
Beginner's luck is someone believing as opposed to knowing all the things that can go wrong.
Okay.
It's hilarious. When I was way back then, and I mean, I'm a young buck. I don't think I had to shave but once a week back when this story takes place, which, yes, is a weird way that I keep track of how old I was. The joke was that newbies could always, like on their first day, sell a car. And the reason was because nobody told them how hard it could be. Nobody told them everything that could go wrong. The worst thing to pollute your headspace with was some people say no. Because if you go out there unencumbered by fact, you just assume that this is the way things always are. Beginner's luck is that you don't yet know what can happen. So you assume that it's going to go right.
What I'm asking for, though, is an entrepreneur who...
Oh, I can give you a specific, but yeah. I wanted to start with the broad brush.
No, because, I dig it.
Because everybody knows the beginner's luck thing. They've heard that expression and they're wondering where that word came from.
Yeah.
All right. So... probably my favorite sort of beginner's luck thing. And it is one of those things where somebody just kind of walked in off the street. They came to me and I can't use names. And I don't even want to necessarily even talk about what industry it's in because I mean, my name's all over it, but, and I don't want to embarrass anybody. The point of the story is that they had done everything but actually try to ask someone for a check. Right. And they're flailing. They're, I mean, you can see the company's in actual existential danger. Right. They may not actually be able to make payroll next week. And they call and they say, hey, we would have called you earlier, but we wouldn't ask you to work for free. and we can't pay you, but you're a friend of ours and we're really in trouble and we're worried we're going to have to fire 20 people. All right. So we all sit down, we get around the table, right? And it's like, okay, tell me how you put your marketing together. Tell me, you know, who's your ideal customer profile? Like I'm really digging into like, you know, the normal day-to-day sales manager-y kind of stuff. And then I asked the question, I went, how many calls do you go on? How many like in-person meetings do you go on in a day? And everybody starts looking at each other around the table like, oh God, he figured it out. And I know all of a sudden the number's zero, but I can't jump in and say it for him. And honestly, half of it is the fact that I'm paralyzed by my own, like, please don't say this, please don't say this, please don't say this, right? And they did. They said, you know, like, well, we haven't actually had any face-to-face meetings. And now I know what's wrong. Because if you put any effort into it whatsoever, and I'm going to try to do the rest of the interview without trashing the studio any further, you know that you can get meetings if you're trying to get meetings. It's closes that are hard to get. If you're not going on any meetings, it's because the effort's just not there to even do it.
Yeah.
So long story short, we move some pieces around the board. We actually get meetings because, again, those aren't so hard. And we literally close the very first one. And the CEO is sitting with me and he's sweating in like a 65 degree room. It's one of the colder rooms I've sat in. And he goes, so do you think we can do this? He can't keep his voice under control.
Yeah.
And I'm like, God, I should have been the one to deliver the closing line because this ends in tears. The lady behind the counter, behind the desk just goes, well, yeah, I mean, at these prices, who wouldn't? We walk out and you would have thought that like the Rocky theme was playing. Like he's all bouncy up on his tiptoes and whatever. And I was like, I don't know what you're celebrating about. You didn't save anybody's job in there. We got to do like 100 more of these just to basically be able to make all your payments for the money you owe to people. And, you know, the sad part is, and this is the reason why I didn't necessarily want to use names, is the fact that it was too late. You couldn't pull the nose up on the plane that late in the game, right? I wish, though, somebody had forced them into their discomfort zone 6 months to a year earlier.
Yeah.
And said like, look, you know what? This job is about getting rejected. It sucks. Go do it anyway, because that's how we get paid. And that's happened a bunch of times. A lot of times you get the first one, or at least you get one of the first few. And you're never very good at it. The first one, you're going to sweat. Your voice is going to crack. I remember the first car I sold, I literally felt like a spectator. I seriously had this weird, like, out of body experience where it was like, okay, I will go get the paperwork. I'm disembodied right now and floating above the rest of you. And I go into the sales manager's office and I went, he wants to do it. And my sales manager, Stuart, who is just a hell of a guy, goes, man, that's great. And I don't know, I think it was like my second day. Right. And my first day was all like that video based training thing where you have to sit there and click through.
This is a car. This is a salesperson.
It has four wheels. If your car has less than four wheels, try not to sell that one. Sell a different one. Yeah. You know, and again, it's just, you have to understand and embrace the fact that the discomfort is what you get paid for. And that's the only way the bills get paid. I know. Nobody likes that part.
No, but it's something that you have to hear, and it's something that is like, there's always the sexy and the unsexy side of things, and like the sexy truths and the unsexy truths to be acknowledged.
Greg Katiki and I were talking about this on my show a few weeks back. He is the director of the Blast Furnace over at the University of Pittsburgh and just a hell of a guy. And he says, and he agrees with me on this, that the startup entrepreneurship, that whole thing has gotten way too fashionable right now.
Yeah.
And there are people who are doing it the same way that kids used to pick up a guitar at 15.
Yeah.
Right. It's like a way to get girls, right? It's a way to look cool. Right. And I was like, oh, everybody will put up with me having weird hair and a t-shirt under my blazer and no socks. Right. You know, it's not about looking good. It's about being good. And, you know, he said the same, he said, nobody wants to hear about the entrepreneur who plowed his entire retirement fund into some idea and is living on ramen noodles and hoping for the best. They want to hear about that person who's the savant, amazing person. Oh, you live in the startup world and you can, you know, go have dinner with Mark Zuckerberg, which nobody does. I'm not sure Mrs. Zuckerberg has dinner with Mark Zuckerberg.
Does he eat? Does he eat?
I'm pretty sure that he is fed a diet of Duracell batteries, actually, and he has a little wind up on the back as a backup power source. But yeah, the idea that this is somehow like, you know, a way to be famous or a way to be, I don't know, deep, right? No, this is like having a job, but harder, and it doesn't pay as well.
Yeah.
Some people, some very select group of people, keep their nose to the grindstone long enough, have the right timing, have the right luck, have the right stick-to-itiveness, and have the right even keel about, like, they don't get too high, they don't get too low, they just kind of keep. It's one of the reasons why I hate compliments, right? Like, I don't hate compliments. I hate dealing with compliments, right? Because, like, I mean, you sat here, you recorded 50 with me, like, you know, everybody making such a big deal about the 50th episode. It's like, no, let's not get too high, right? Because for it, the pendulum swings the other way too, right? And if you allow yourself to start thinking, you know, like, okay, well
that's also
now we're living, right? You know, yeah. The lows are there too.
That's also the sales experience, though, is if you are doing it consistently over time, you know that the lows are accompanied by highs and the highs are accompanied by lows. Like you, when you get that high, you're like, oh no.
Yeah. You got to think about your long-term average.
Yeah. Right?
Just slowly pushing your batting average up over time. Yeah. You can't, those people, I used to work for a guy who used to tell us, you guys aren't selling enough, go get in debt. Right. That was the strategy. You guys aren't in enough debt. You guys need to go buy cars and houses, you know, go get in debt. That'll motivate you to go close some deals. Right.
Yeah.
That sort of myopic, like short-term thinking is, I think, what people are used to. You know, like a sales rep goes out, they close a big deal, they get a big commission check, they go and blow it on Puff Daddy's vodka or whatever, right? You know, like just weird things that they didn't buy for themselves before.
Yeah.
And then they're right back to square one and they have to do it all over again, right? As opposed to thinking about, like, I want to put some money aside for this. I eventually want to invest in companies that I believe in. You know, living below your means, being ready for a rainy day. That's... in my view, those are the people who make it.
Yeah.
You can be successful over the short term thinking the other way, but I've seen a lot of people burn out. They go in a different direction.
Yeah. And it gets back to the long-term thinking where we kind of started everything off.
I think you have to. I mean, it's key to everything. You know, Chris Rock made me laugh years ago when he said, you know, people tell you life is short, but life is long. And medical bills are high, you know, and you think about everything that can be thrown at you. You know, I know you're a bit of a futurist and a bit of a technologist. So let me throw you a side topic here. We are living in this weird part of human history where, number one, the lifespan is extending to a point where the amount of money you can make before you're 65 is probably not going to be enough to ride you out to the end of your natural life, right? You know, people living into their 90s used to be the stuff of legend. Now, like my wife didn't lose one of her grandparents before 90, right? You know, it's like it's a common occurrence now, right?
That's the award for crossing, looking both ways when you cross the street, basically.
Well, yeah. That's a crappy award, man. We need a better one. Like, hey, all your joints are going to hurt. Well, I'm really glad I did that. Now imagine it's 120.
Yeah.
And you haven't worked since you were 65. Okay, so now we start the whole, you know, UBI, universal basic income conversation. And it's like, okay, well, I'm here to tell you that that is not going to pass in the U.S. before you and I retire. And you're a young man, and I'm still willing to bet on it, right? I'm older than you, and I'm a lot more willing to bet on my own. So you say, okay, well, I guess we'll just cross that bridge when we come to it. But wait, hang on, let's add complexity. The robots are coming for everybody's job, right? So you may not even make it all the way to 65. You might have your job be completely replaced and have no backup plan.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to bum people out. I am, however, trying to say that you need to live below your means. You need to plan for the long game. And you need to assume that no matter what you do, you're a sales rep. You have to create, and I'd like to say that sales and what I do, I am a glorified copywriter. This is what I am. I write copy. I just write better copy than other people. you have to be able to identify value that people didn't see, not everybody, just some people didn't see, and then communicate that value to those people who didn't see it in the hopes that you can pick up some of the money as it changes hands. That's what it is. If you see something that somebody else would value and you can communicate that fact to them and somehow facilitate their getting of that value, the robots can't completely cancel you out. And I realize that's a weird, simplistic view on it, but I'm trying to boil it down to the most basic element, right? Which is, again, if you're in that person, or if you're in that place where you're hoping that you're going to be able to make your mortgage payment, I'm not sure you're in the best place right now. It's not looking great for, you know, the money that you're able to save if your budget is that tight. The money you're able to save probably won't take you as far as you want it to. And then I can't tell you what that means long term. I can't tell you, you know, like, what's the impact on your life going to be after that. So again, even keel.
Yeah. But even in terms of deciding what you're going to do, like, should I have a midlife crisis and change my job? What direction should I go in? If we really just go in on a vacuum on that notion, you're going to live a long time and you could spend as much time retired as you did working.
Yeah.
Hypothetically.
Right.
Take that scenario.
I honestly think it's more likely than ever. Yeah. That it's going
to
happen.
Well, the way you can change the math of that is to be doing work that you don't necessarily need to retire from. Like plenty of people approach retirement. They're like, I need to be out of here. I cannot do this.
Yeah, I get you.
But there's the people who, I could do this for another 20 years. Like, I had a professor who would come in, he could barely walk. He was like 70 something, but he just loved talking economics. It was what got him going. It was what woke him up. And that's, like, to me, that is the practicality, really just the practical side of pursuing something like this. Not in like the sexy, like, you're so rich, or like the man.
Yeah, I honestly run screaming from that whole thought. Yeah.
But doing something that you don't love 100% of the time, but you get excited to do, that to me, like, that's my hedge against the robots. And my hedge against living to 110 is maybe I could continue
eating
doing
more
this.
Bacon. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a vegetarian. I don't have that problem. I'm going to live forever. I don't know, man.
It sounds like you're not super optimistic.
I'm worried about people. I'm worried that people make the wrong decision sometimes out of a sense of duty to the wrong things. I'm worried that when the robots take the jobs that, okay, let's just play a thought exercise. 10% of the jobs in the U.S. disappear because of automation. Nobody thinks that's a crippling event because they go, oh, 10% is not a big number. 10% is a huge number. It's a gigantic number. And let's assume that that 10% is added on to this, say, 7% that's fairly normal for unemployment, right? Of the people who are seeking it, right? So now you're at 17% unemployment, right? This means that you're not putting cash into the pizza joint, the Amazon.com.
The consumers dry up.
Yeah. All of a sudden now, you know, like, so it, an economy is basically the speed of money, right?
Right.
It's not more money. It's the speed that the money is moving through the system.
Yeah.
And we just literally just, like, forgot to change our oil in the engine, right?
Yeah.
And now it's not moving through as quickly.
Yeah.
I would like to see people think a little bit more defensively. Not in terms of following dreams and all of those kinds of things. Like, you're right. You should try to do the things. I firmly believe you only live once, right? And you need to make sure you don't regret what you did. That's a separate topic, though. I worry about people following the signs and trying something on the side, or getting a little creative or inventive because they don't feel sufficiently threatened by the possibilities. Let's go back to that person who I said, like, there's no money in their budget to save for the future because they bought a house that's too big and they just can't hang, right? That person needs a healthy dose of fear because it could wipe them out. And I've seen it too many times. A lot of times you don't get, in the sales game, a lot of times you get people who are not educated on personal finance. You don't get people who are educated on how to manage a budget, how to manage their money. They're encouraged, like I said, go get in debt. Is like a, it's a running joke in the sales business, right? You know, it's like, oh, that's a, you know, that's a funny thing, right? And then the next thing is like, oh, well, you know what? You can't do this job because you don't have a fancy enough car. You're never going to be successful in this because your suit isn't shiny enough, right? Okay. Well, all of that adds up to, again, you're not putting enough money away for a rainy day. You know, medical bankruptcy is a thing. You know who ends up in medical bankruptcy? Old people. You know who's going to be old people?
Everybody.
Well, you would hope, right? You know, the majority of us anyway. So anyway, yeah, I guess I have a fairly dark view on it. And I don't mean to be a downer on anybody. I wish people were just thinking about, let me put it in a more uplifting way. How about this? You deserve to unleash your creativity.
Yeah.
And if you're me, it's that concern about the future that gives you license to do it.
Yeah. I tend to be more optimistic, and usually, so when I see that same event, I see these people getting automated.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, it's not all going to happen like in one fell swoop.
Yeah.
It can happen very fast. Yeah. I'm not saying it can't happen all at once, but it's the notion that I actually think that it's somewhat, what's the word? Dismissive or disrespectful to think that like the truck driver doesn't know that self-driving cars are like a technology on the rise. And I'm not here to prognosticate that that's 2 years or 5 years or 7 years away or never happening. But
yeah,
the thought crosses his mind, like, what if robots do this? What if that happens?
Oh, yeah.
And some people, that moves them to action. That moves them to start the other thing. And other people, you're saying, talking about that pain. It is that forcing function. Like, you got to go figure it out right now.
Yeah.
Because, sorry, paycheck's gone. And the optimism I have is just generally long-term that kind of forcing function has happened in other forms over the course of history. And what it sounds like you're saying is this is going to be more dramatic.
Well, how about this? It has with more cushion around it. In other words, the timeline has not been so crowded with threat events to industries.
Okay.
You know, when Henry Ford did his thing, you needed more people to work on the line as a result because more people were buying cars. No threat event there. There were no cars really on the road before that, right? When they took people out of dangerous environments, we celebrated it because we don't want people dying in the meatpacking industry or in the coal mining industry or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But now you're getting to things where, so Flippy the robot, did you read this? Where the burger flipping robot for fast food joints is now a thing?
Okay.
Okay, so Flippy the robot is out there. And I'm sorry, my chair is so squeaky. I'm just really heavy. Anyway, I told you, I don't work out as much as you do. Now, a whole bunch of people want to pin that on the fight for 15. Okay? And I'm not trying to have a political argument with anybody. I am just going to say that they're not wrong in the fact that the fight for 15 may be created opportunity for someone who has a similar mindset to me, that there's opportunity in the fact that this is now in the national discussion, $15 per hour minimum wage. So somebody says, dude, we totally need to make a robot that can do 3 of the 5 tasks behind the counter at Burger King, right?
Yeah.
Jack Roseman, Pittsburgh legend, said, ride what moves, right? You know, it find something that's in the headlines and then ride it. So Flippy the robot comes out. How many people does Flippy displace? It's not 10% of the economy like we were talking about a minute ago. It's a goodly number, though. And who is it? Young people? Who are already waiting for people to exit the workforce, right? Unskilled labor, like all kind of people who already kind of have a bunch of problems that, you know, we'd like to not have them burdened with, right? But on the other side of the spectrum, I can't remember who made the AI robot that does your law research for you so that you don't have as many billable hours in the legal profession.
Yep.
Okay, buddy, they're coming at that end too, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I guess what I'm saying is that I would just like to see people have a little bit more urgency about unleashing their own creativity about this. Like, there's stuff out there to be done, but I promise you, you're not going to find it by standing still for 5 decades. Okay. You got to keep moving. That's all I'm trying to impart here. I'm not an economist. I don't know enough about any of these other topics except what I read and what is coming and who's losing jobs and who's gaining jobs, right? But if you are looking for, and this is, by the way, I told you I had some challenges for the end of the show, yep. right? Dare yourself to unlock your creativity is my first one. Come up with a reason, a motivation. Yes, there are positive motivations and negative motivations, right? Dare yourself, though, to come up with a reason to unlock your creativity, because the thing that got you here will not keep you here. Did I make it a little bit happier for you at least? You look worried for a minute.
It's just interesting to hear that perspective because I know that thought exists. I know that the optimistic viewpoint exists, and entertaining those and thinking about them deeply and having these types of conversations are, at least I hope, what will result in solutions.
The next thing, yeah. I mean, and, I think it's off brand for a lot of people to talk like this.
Yeah, but
I don't think that's a perspective you hear very often.
Yeah.
Because people are afraid of tarnishing their brand.
Yeah. And that's also just, yeah. I mean, you have to be able to acknowledge the dark to create the light. Like that's, you can't have one without the other.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you have to have a reason that you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I dig it.
And I actually push that on people pretty hard. You know, one of the key things you can ask yourself is, and again, we're back to my challenges. Why are you doing what you're doing? You don't have to justify it. I just want you to know what it is.
Yeah.
You know how many people don't even have a goal? Like one goal. Like what, why'd you go to work today? Right. And don't tell me to, you know, because you need a paycheck. That's easy. That's a free throw. I'm not interested in that answer. Right?
Yeah.
Why are you where you are? Wherever that is. I don't think a lot of people can answer it. Like I actually, how old are you now?
25.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was, right? Okay, so I was a young dad, but I pretty much had that thing figured out, right? Like the bills were getting paid, the formula was, you know, taking care of the diapers, the right? The house, the wife, I kind of had, I don't want to say like luxury, but comfort. Like and this is where I initially fell into the comfort trap. And it probably took me like 3 years to realize that I had been operating without a next goal. You go, oh my God, what was I doing? Wasting time, basically. Now, granted, I was able to fill it with plenty of, you know, movies and trips to Kennywood and, you know, like other things that made it seem like I was doing stuff. But I wasn't actually advancing the ball. I wasn't actually moving toward anything that I wanted to do or be. So that's my second challenge.
I dig it.
I'm glad.
Well, definitely need people to take those challenges. Also need people who've been inspired by this to get more of your coaching through your podcast, Pitchworks. What other digital coordinates can we give people?
All right. So everything that we have is always tagged to Pitchworks. So if you just do a search with whatever your preferred platform is, unless you're a Snapchat person, you'll find us, right? And it's really nice spelling things wrong. PITCHWERKS. As it turns out, we didn't have to fight anybody for that particular piece of real estate on any of the major networks. So yeah, throw the E in works. And then that's our website too. So pitchworks.com. You can go in there. Thank you for helping us celebrate our 50th episode. You know, in a way, like I said, I don't want to get too high about it, but it is a very important milestone to me and the community that we've kind of built around the show. I wanted to make sure that we didn't treat it like it was nothing.
Yeah.
One of the things I like to do, if you ever want to just ping me with something, Twitter's where you find me. I mean, honestly, like all those other brands we operate and whatnot, but I do the most of my sort of like unofficial coaching and that sort of a thing through DM on Twitter.
It's the water cooler.
People just, yeah, exactly. They just hit me up and be like, okay, look, I'm trying to get rid of a co-founder. How do I do that? Like, I'm not sure I'm qualified to talk about this particular situation, but like, why? You know, you're sitting there like, okay, I'm in the middle of some weird soap opera, you know, yeah. It's like happening in Sydney, Australia. But yeah, that's the best way to reach out. You know, the LinkedIn company page is actually kind of interesting. Gives us a little bit more room to stretch out in terms of like seeing people in their natural digital habitat of their workplace, right? But yeah, I mean, if you just want to have a conversation, please find us there, Twitter.
Fantastic. Well, we'll be sure to link that in the show notes for everybody so they can check it out at goingdeepwitharon.com/podcast. And just real quick, one more time, I want you to lay those two challenges on the audience again.
So The first one is, I need you to come up with a reason that you can simply identify. It could be a positive, it could be a negative. Why are you turning to your creativity? Why are you allowed to unleash your creativity? Is it because you're trying to go somewhere? Is it because you're helping somebody else? Is it because you want to be or want to do something, right? And then the second one is, why are you doing what you're doing now or what you've been doing? I don't care. As long as it's important to you or not important. You know, I mean, you are the only judge. I don't think there's any one truth for anybody. But if you can't answer that simple question, like, why am I doing what I'm doing? And don't, I mean, be ruthless. Is it really the best use of my time? Is it really the best use of my one life? I don't know. You got to answer that. But if you can't even ask the question, then you'll never get to the next thing you want to get to. And honestly, years will pass and then you'll realize that you burned some time and fuel on things that you wish you hadn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Powerful stuff. We just went deep with Scott McTaggart. Hope everyone out there has a fantastic day.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening and sticking through all the way to the end. Please hit subscribe if you've not already done so. Sign up for the Going Deep Summit at goingdeepwitharon.com/event. That's January 27th, but prices are going up soon. And make sure you check out the concurrent episode over on the Pitchworks podcast. That's PitchWerks. You'll be able to find the 50th episode where me and Scott get into it, have an amazing conversation, and just keep this gravy train rolling, baby. If you want to keep the gravy train rolling yourself, you need to be excited about some of our forthcoming episodes. A ton of great content is going to be coming out of Thrival 2017. We have some big interviews there and many more exciting things coming down the pipe in the next few months. So I hope that you'll stay tuned to Going Deep with Aaron Watson. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Connect with Aaron on Twitter and Instagram at AaronWatson59.